Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Life Sciences Revolution Podcast. I'm your host, Alex Wise, and today we're going to be taking a dive into the world of life sciences company management and the European biotechnology SPAC realm. We're going to be speaking with Eduardo Bravo. He's a business management professional with decades of experience in C-suite and board positions at a number of biotechnology companies. He's been the CEO of Nordic Nanovector, Celerix, and Tegenix. And during his time at Tegenix, he oversaw several financing rounds, the company's IPO on NASDAQ, and their eventual acquisition by Takeda Pharmaceuticals. But more recently, Eduardo has joined LSP, one of Europe's largest life sciences investing firms, as a partner to take on running the first biotech SPAC in Europe, the European Biotech Acquisition Corporation. So, without further ado, let's jump into my conversation with Eduardo. So Eduardo, we talked a little bit offline about what it means to be the CEO of a biotech company. You gave me this great analogy that really stuck with me about what it means to be in your role. So can you tell us a little bit about what was your day in the life as the head of a biotech company?
There's not a biotech CEO. Let me start there. I think that you may have very different profiles to run a company. In my case, I came without scientific background, so my key role really as a biotech CEO was to surround myself by the best possible team, and use my time to the things that no one else, I believe, could do better than what I could do, which is, hiring that team, making sure that you get the best possible investors, that you have a relation with those investors, that you get the credibility, because you're going to hit bumps on the road. So you need your investors to understand and to trust you, so they are with you on the bad moments. And then, again, very importantly, we say that you need to be ready to do things that everyone can do. In a big pharma, that's where I was coming from, you always turn back and there's someone of a lower rank that is there to help you or to do the less interesting things. I think that in a biotech, you look back, there's no one there. So you just need to do it by yourself. And I think that that's what, distinguishes, the successful companies are those that are full of people that are senior enough to take the decisions and humble enough to roll up the sleeves and do the work.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's key to make sure you have all the right people for everything. You gave me this analogy where you said that being the CEO is almost like being the head chef. You have to make sure that you have all the right equipment to make sure you can get your job done. And so I know that a lot of head chefs, they have their favorite knife or some pieces of equipment that they just can't work without. So I was wondering if you had or any pieces of equipment, whether those are the key personnel or items that you always need to make sure that your restaurant and company is running smoothly.
Yeah, can I choose 20 key pieces?
Of course.
I can't. Let me choose two which are probably on the for people on the opposite places. One will be the CFO. I mean, I was super lucky, and Tegenix, and for 13 years I worked together with Claudia D'Augusta, which we were both a new CEO, new CFO for a biotech, and having someone that you can rely, someone that it's a perfect complement, because again, each CEO probably needs a different type of team because of his own characteristics, and I'm the super optimistic and the everything can be done guy, and having Claudia by my side that will always force us to look at maybe it may not go well, so what is the plan then, and have a more cautious approach was a great team effort. And then on the other hand, I still think that my or the company's assistant and the company's Laura Barrios again was with me for the best part of those 13 years, And, you know, you need to have someone that you can trust that will take care of all the other things that, you know, no one takes care of. And any sort of the heart of the company when you're not there, and you know that everyone trusts her and that she really can deal with a lot of the things that otherwise will overwhelm you as a CEO. So those two people, I will take them anywhere, anytime.
Absolutely. You have to make sure you have your right-hand people where everyone is exactly on board and ready to go at the drop of a needle to work on the project. So it's good to hear that you found those type of people. In this case, can you do me a favor and just walk us through, you know, maybe the make or break points for taking a benchtop research and using it to create a successful biotech company that, you know, you eventually sell, or I know in your case, you know, had an acquisition by a larger company. So what are the real key points in that process from going all the way in the beginning to whatever the end goal may be?
Oof, I think that I will go back to what we define as values of Federico Stagenics. You know, you need top-notch science. At the end, you know, if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. And you know, there's nothing you can do to make a molecule work or to make cells do what they cannot do. So let's start there, because without that ingredient, I mean, it's impossible to make the recipe. But I think that there is this combination of, you know, making sure that you have enough money to do what you need to do. You're going to be cutting corners. So I think that people underestimate luck. And, you know, one of my favorite phrases is always this Napoleon phrase that you don't need good generals, you need lucky generals. Because there's a lot of places in which you need that extra bit of luck because you've taken a risk, or because, you know, just simply things go your way. You know, I think that we had our fair share of unlucky events, and I can go through some. But also, I think that, you know, at the end, you need a little bit of luck for things to happen properly. But it's, you know, recruiting the right people, getting the right investors, and then resilience. I think that anyone, unfortunately, there's a couple of companies out there in which, you know, everything happened perfectly nicely, and, you know, in record time, they deliver, you know, record valuations and whatever. But for most of the companies, you know, you have ups and downs, you have big downs, and you know, is there whether the team and the investors have the resilience and the vision, and they are convinced that really that was either bad luck or, you know, a bad clinical trial or a bad result, but that there's something that needs to be done. So for me, those are the things. And, you know, at Tygenics, I can clearly say that there were 3 points in during the history of the company in which the company was almost going down. And, you know, we were saved by super good investors. I always say that, you know, without Grifols, at some point we would have been down. They took the risk, and I'm super happy that they took a super good profit at the end. But, you know, there's been 3 times in which, you know, the company was very, very, very close to actually disappearing. And a few years later, and not that many years, you know, at the end, the company was sold for $540 million. So I like this phrase of someone saying that, you know, success is that thing that is waiting after most of the people have decided to stop working. And you know, you need to keep trying. You need to keep doing what is right and stay there and have faith that, you know, what you're doing is right. The product will come out. And, you know, that's the biggest, you know, recognition that I believe we have is getting a product for a very debilitating disease approved in Europe and available to patients for the time being in Europe and hopefully very soon all over the world. That's what I feel most proud of myself and the whole Tygenics team.
Absolutely. You know, there are always going to be those tough times and those hurdles that you have to get over. And so as the CEO, what do you use as your grounding ideas? And how do you keep yourself motivated, on track, and so you can get over those hurdles and at the end of the day, you know, turn a profit for investors, and also, as you said, get a great product out on the shelf and, you know, helping people in need. So what do you use to keep yourself motivated?
Well, you need to have, why does the company, we you know, you cannot communicate enough with the employees, but, you know, every quarter we were having these town hall meetings in which, you know, the first thing I always remind everyone is there is a reason we exist. And the reason is that there's thousands of patients with these complex perianal fistulas that have no treatment available. And we believe that we have something that might help them. You know, if we, if the product doesn't work, or if those patients were not there, if there was not that, then there would be no reason for the company to exist. So I think that having this very clear understanding of why the company exists and what we're trying to do is one key piece. Then is understanding and making sure that people get feedback from those patients and the doctors that treat those patients. And I remember that Damian Garcia Olmo, the guy that had the idea about these stem cells, you know, was always giving feedback of, you know, how patients will come to him after being cured of this very debilitating disease, thanks to these cells. And, you know, it was, you know, come on, guys, we need to make this available to patients. This we cannot fail. We need to go that extra step. And then just by being super open and honest and transparent to people. So when we were in real difficulties, people knew that we were in real difficulties. People knew when we were going to run out of cash. People knew what were the plans to try to solve that issue. But I, you know, there's been twice in which I was facing people, you know, and you know, again, it was not only myself, but, you know, you feel responsible for in one of the moments, it was 70 people, and that's their families and their mortgages and the schools of their kids, and say, like, you know, guys, we have cash for the next 3 months and then it will be over. And we think that we're going to get the cash to get us through this. But, you know, I want people to know. I don't want anyone to come 3 months down the road and tell me, you should have told me. And, you know, we never lost an employee on those difficult times. Never. Not a single one. And that I, again, I feel super proud that people stick to us, trusted us, the management team, in getting the cash, which we did. And, you know, continue concentrated on, you know, the only important thing, which was getting Allo-Fi-Cell to the market and to the patients. And that's what we end up doing.
Having everyone stay with you through those difficult times is an impressive feat. It's almost as if you have the science backing the company, you have the luck at putting you on the right track, but you also have, you know, that artistry of, you know, orchestrating and keeping everyone focused on the common goal. And I commend you for that one. It's a very impressive feat. Pushing a little bit, I know there's the C-suite of a biotech company. Then there are also the board members and strategic advisors as well. So what are the big differences between, you know, those two roles, the board members and strategic advisors? And how does someone end up in that position? How do they play a role in this picture that we have going on here?
Well, I think that you need completely different profiles, or you need to ensure, because sometimes you have profiles that could be on the management team that are on the board, or people that are on the board that are on the scientific advisory board or whatever. And I think that people need to understand what is the remit, what is that they are there to accomplish. You know, as a you know, C-suite, you need to define what you think is right, and you need to convince the board that that's the best the company can do. As the board, you have the you know, you're responsible vis-a-vis the shareholders, that the company is managed properly, and that, you know, that the management has not, I would say, neglected any aspect, that they have looked at the risks, that they are taking good care of those, and that they are doing what you believe is right. But, you know, you cannot get the board to be the management. You cannot micromanage the management. If the board needs to micromanage the CEO or the management, then you have the wrong CEO or the wrong management. I think that the board is there to be the, I like the board, sounding board, to make sure that, you know, you go through a very experienced group of people to explain how you see things, what are your plans, what are the things that you've looked at, and what they can tell you is, like, have you also considered this? Have you considered this risk? Are you aware of this other thing? Are there other ways? Have you looked into other opportunities? And then they hold, of course, the management team accountable on delivering on the plan. Because at the end, you know, every time you have a budget, you have a contract between the board, which represents the shareholders, and the management on, give me the money, if you know, I need so many million to do this. You cannot just spend the money without doing the plan. So you need to execute on the plan, and you're responsible of delivering on what you have promised. And then the scientific advisory board, they are just super good experts that I think that have a very consultative approach. At the end, you listen to them, and but then you do what you think is right. And I don't think that the scientific advisory board should be running the company, should be running the trials. They are there to tell you what, as scientists and as experts, they see in the disease area or the treatments or the whatever. But, you know, I've been myself in the trap that, you know, we did a clinical trial that was super interesting for the scientific advisory board. It was probably the most and the best designed clinical trial for a certain indication, but actually it was completely impossible to recruit. So sometimes those scientific advisors, you know, are blinded a little bit by the science and the but they lack sometimes the pragmatism of having something that will do the work on a decent amount of time with decent amount of resources. And you just need those three pieces, you know, the board, your C-suite, and the strategic advisors, and you just need to get from each of them what they should bring to the party.
I see. So everyone's got their own realm of expertise, and it's the synergy of all three, you know, come together and get keep everyone on track and make sure that the operating business is going well, right?
Yep.
Perfect. Okay. So let's switch gears a little bit. Let's go over to the SPAC. So I know you recently joined LSP as a partner to take on fundraising the first biotech-related SPAC in Europe. But before we even get into the intricacies of that process and how it's going, I think we need to give our audience a little bit of background info. So to start off, what is a special purpose acquisition company and why are we hearing so much about them right now?
Well, let me start with the second part. We're hearing a lot because there's many that have suddenly appeared and there is an incredible amount of money that has gone into these special purpose acquisition corporations in different sectors. These vehicles existed for a long time, you know, they have become in the last couple of years, as I said, you know, very popular because a lot of money has gone into those. There's some of them that have made some very spectacular transactions. In the healthcare space and in the biotech space, which is where we are talking, there's a significant number of SPACs. And what they really are is that you get a group of people that have sort of a mandate. It's like a search fund in private equity, but with a public vehicle. So at the end, you know, in the case of LSP, just it's easier probably to give it with one SPAC in mind. In LSP, we just got, you know, the four founding partners of LSP plus myself as operating partner and the five of us created this SPAC. So you get a company and then you go and convince investors to invest in this empty shell company. This is what they are called, blank check companies. So we raise $127 million. So there's investors that trust that the five of us with the team of LSP can find the right target to merge with this pool of cash. So basically now what we have is a pool of cash, $127 million, and we have the expertise of LSP. And what we're looking for is, in our case, a European biotech company that is that wants to go and list into NASDAQ and that can use as an alternative of getting there this special acquisition corporation. So if we like a company and the company likes us, then we will merge that European biotech with our SPAC. Of course, the management of the European biotech will stay as the management of the combined entity. We will stay on the board. And what they will get is a ticker on NASDAQ. So they will be listed. They get access to the $127 million that we have on the bank, plus a certain amount of money that will be raised on the transaction. And it's a very efficient and quick way for a European company to be quoted on NASDAQ. And for us, it's just our mandate is from US investors, the majority, find a European company that could be a good candidate to be floated here. And for us, it will be difficult to know which one we should choose, So you choose one for us and we become de facto investors, because we're investors on the SPAC, and those investors become investors on the European company that goes to NASDAQ. That's how it works. And that's where we are. So we've raised the money and now we're in the process of looking for one right company in Europe that could be interested in going to NASDAQ and that we believe has the potential to do well as a US listed company.
Great. So I know when I first heard the idea of a SPAC, it took me a few times to get it all straightened out. So let me make sure that we have it clear cut for our audience here. So the general idea is that you go out and you raise money to take a company public, but you don't actually have the underlying operating business at the time that you're raising the capital. So in reality, you're creating a sort of shell to hold the cash and LP investments while you go out and find the right company that fits the shoe. So essentially, you're raising the capital just based on yourself and LSP, or I guess we can call them SPAC sponsors, on your reputation as a successful business manager in whatever realm the SPAC is intending to acquire a company. And so for your case, a European biotech company. Is that a good way to look at it?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Perfect. Well, and in that case, now that we have it clearly laid out, I guess the next logical question that our listeners are probably thinking, and you know, you hinted at it, is why? Why are you going to take a company public via SPAC as opposed to a traditional IPO?
Okay. And again, I need to be specific here. So I'm going to go through our thesis of why a European SPAC. So a European company that wants to go public in the US, and you know, basically all good companies, all good biotech companies want to go public in NASDAQ, you know, because Europe, it doesn't exist. You know, it's 27 different stock markets, and there's no real funds or enough funds, enough liquidity. So companies that have gone public in Europe get trapped in this in these public markets in their country, where then raising additional funds to develop the company becomes more and more difficult. So companies have realized, okay, you need to run them more like a US company. So more private money has gone in the private rounds. And that, thanks God, has been the case in the last few years. But once the company get to a certain maturity, they are looking at NASDAQ. Now, to get into NASDAQ, you need the support of US investors. So there's two ways of getting that support. One is what I would call the traditional route. And the traditional route was to do, or is to do, a crossover round with some of the good names of US investors. And then between three and 9 months after that crossover round, you go and do an IPO. So this is a two-step process in which you end up having your company public. So that means that you have to negotiate first with a syndicate of investors to do the crossover round, which usually is done at a lower valuation because those guys put the money in this crossover round at a discount, so they get a significant uplift by helping the company go in public. And then they participate, and of course, they help anchor the IPO a few months later. This is one process. Without those US investors on board, it's almost impossible for a European company to go public. Okay. Now, what that becomes a pretty lengthy, it is risky because you never know where the market will be 3, 6, 9 months down the road. And it's pretty expensive in terms of bank fees and legal fees and all that. And then it's pretty dilutive because when you do the maths of the dilution of the IPO, the step up in valuation, the dilution of the crossover first, and then the IPO, it becomes pretty dilutive. So SPAC simplifies very, very enormously this process. You just negotiate once. You know that once you've agreed with a sponsor on a certain valuation, that transaction is taking place. And then in approximately 3 to 4 weeks, you become a US listed company, you have the money in the bank, and you can go ahead with your life. And the US investors are part of the SPAC investors if you choose the right SPAC. So that is what we've done for the company. We've done the exercise of getting the US investors on the SPAC. We will help them in getting other US investors on the pipe that you do on the transaction. And then in one go, in 3-4 weeks, they will be quoted at the agreed price. So lower dilution, more certainty, much quicker. So that's what we offer to the companies. Is this the only way? Is this the best way? Well, I think that is an alternative. It's a very attractive alternative. And I think that if you're a European company that does not have the best US investors already among your shareholders, it's something that you should seriously consider.
So it sounds like, you know, in the European SPAC space for biotech companies, which I appreciate you making sure that we all know that we're talking about that realm in particular, it's almost it's a little bit of a shortcut from a time perspective. And as you mentioned, worrying about the US investor base and who you're dealing with. But all right, thank you. That's a good basis there. But, you know, there's still a lot to unpack. You mentioned a lot of things, you know, the pipe, crossovers. So we'll get into that in due time. But first, let's just dig into the basic components that are involved in this, you know, black box process. So let's talk a little bit more about choosing a company. How do you go out and find the right private company? And what are you keeping in mind as you look at prospective, you know, princes and princesses for your SPAC? And I guess as a follow-up, what happens if you don't find the right company? And how long do you have to find that company?
Yeah, so the mandate, again, starting by the end, the mandate is 24 months. So we have 24 months to execute on a potential transaction. And basically, if after those 24 months, we have not found the right company, then investors will get their money back, okay? And all the money that has been spent is actually our own money. So it's the money of the sponsors that they've put at risk, because investors have the right always to get all their money back if the transaction does not happen. There is no hidden cost, I would say, for investors of the SPAC. So that's what happens if there's no transaction. Now, what do you do is, well, from the moment you close the capital raise, that was mid-March, what we've done is, you know, try to reach out to as many companies as possible that we believe may fit the criteria. You know, European biotech, only in the what we call red biotech, which is therapeutic. So we don't do medtech, we don't do wearables, we don't do artificial intelligence, and we don't do healthcare services. We just do therapeutic biotech. Then companies need to be mature enough to be capable of listing on NASDAQ. This is not, SPAC is not a way of taking public a company that cannot go public on its own. This is very important to understand. You know, the SPAC is an alternative for a company that can go public to go public. So you need to look at companies that are biotech in Europe, red biotech, that are mature enough to go to the public markets, and that then have, you know, compelling science, so that they have, that's what we've defined, at least proof of principle, so that they've seen in humans that the theory behind the science translates. But ideally, we want companies with clinical data, companies that have proven that the products work the way they are supposed to work in humans, and that have, you know, a certain size, because, you know, with 127 million that we have, plus the pipe that you do every time you do a transaction from a SPAC, you need a company that can spend or will have a use of proceeds of about $200 million plus. So that also limits the companies, because you need then a company that will have a pre-money valuation prior to the transaction of at least $250 million. So those are the criteria. To my surprise, there is more companies that fit those criteria that I thought we will find. But then it's the process of meeting those companies, understanding the science, looking at the data, and deciding which of those companies you think is the best or a very good candidate to eventually be successful in the market. Once you've decided that you like a certain company, you need to convince them that you are a good option for them. And that is, you know, proving to be maybe more difficult than what I thought, because there's a lot of misperception in Europe about the SPACs. So the SPACs are well known in the US, but they are still very early times in Europe. So I'm spending a lot of time educating CEOs, boards, investors about the characteristic of SPACs. Again, not to convince them that they are the way, but that they are a good alternative that should be considered. And that's where we are. And hopefully, you know, sooner rather than later, we will convince one of the companies we like that we're a good match, and that then we can merge the two companies and we can move on.
Right. You know, you're really pioneering the European biotech SPAC realm there. So I can imagine you're going to have to go through a lot of those explanatory processes somewhat as you're doing right now. So out of curiosity, how many companies do you expect that you guys are going to be speaking with over the course of this SPAC? Is it, you know, 5, 10, 100?
This may surprise, because a lot of them, of course, disappear very quickly. But we have a log of all the companies that have approached us, and it goes past 125, just to give you an idea. And we started mid-March. Of course, a lot of them, kill them very quickly, either because they are not on the geography, they are not on the red space only, they are super early, or they are something that we feel is wrong for what we were looking for. But there's there's a lot of companies that we think are interesting, but maybe it's a little bit early. So we keep them on the back burner, eventually maybe for a future SPAC. And I would say that we're concentrating on about 20 companies at this point in time.
Gotcha. Sounds like there's a pretty big push and pull between finding the right company on your end and making sure that the company on their end, that you're right for them. I mean, you don't want to be going out and finding and, I guess, chaperoning benchtop research without proof of concept, taking them out and trying to launch them publicly through a SPAC. But great. So you mentioned PIPE a few times. So first off, what is PIPE and how can those investments be used in the SPAC realm?
So a PIPE comes from the private investment in a public equity. So basically, the SPAC, our SPAC called EBAC, is a public company. I mean, we're quoted. You can buy and sell shares of EBAC on NASDAQ. And what you do when you have identified the target, let's say that it was Tagenix, okay? Just so we don't use a company that exists. So then, first of all, you go to your investors. You go to the key investors inside your SPAC, and you explain to them why you think that that's a good company and why you think that is a good investment. Because then they have the choice to back the transaction. And this is every investor individually. Or they can say, you know what? I don't like Tagenix. I want my money back. So first thing that you need to do is ensure that you can convince your investors. That's one thing. But then you go to the PIPE. And the PIPE is actually going to investors that are not in shareholders of EBAC, to explain to them and to sell them the transaction. So you raise additional capital on the transaction. So you go to investors and you tell them, listen, you're not an investor in EBAC, but this is the transaction that we're putting together. We want to raise an additional, let's say, $50, $100 million. Would you be interested in being a shareholder of this company? And that part, that PIPE, They say in England the proof is in the pudding. And now there's the joke in SPACs that the proof is on the PIPE. Because investors of the SPAC usually have some warrants. So they have a sweeter deal. The investors on the private company, of course, want to have a public company, because that will mean that the investment is liquid. So having very well recognized investors that participate on the PIPE without any sweetener is the best validation that the deal is the right deal at the right price. And that's the reason why the PIPEs are so important. And you need to be do a sizable PIPE when you do the transaction for the deal to be seen by the external world as a successful deal, which is very important, because the end of the story is not the transaction. The sponsors live with the company for at least 12 months, just at least. And that means that we're interested on the long-term performance of the company. We're not interested in doing the transaction. So we need to ensure that we have the right investors, that there will be the right aftermarket, exactly the same as if it was an IPO. And that's the reason why the pipe is so important.
Gotcha. So the pipe is this secondary, almost add-on investment round to help sweeten the deal all around for the company that's getting acquired, and also allows other investors to get involved before everything is finalized, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Gotcha. Gotcha. Well, in that case, now that we're all SPAC experts, let's make sure we have the general skeleton done. So you fundraise the initial proceeds, then potentially go out and get the pipe funding going. Then you go out and find the private company, take the company public, then boom, done. Public company, SPAC, done. So fantastic. Now we have all of that written down in the back of our minds. What advice would you give to those who maybe want to launch their own SPAC, if we have any of those people listening? So what are the key ingredients? I mean, you've mentioned obviously a number, but key ingredients and advice for anyone looking to do this.
Well, LSP did a lot of work in trying to understand what differentiated the performance of the successful SPACs versus the no so successful SPACs. And with everything, there's very good funds, not so good funds. There's very good banks, not so good banks. Here is the same. And if you look at what defines the best successful stories of the SPACs that have the SPAC already, is one having a sponsor that is an expert in the area. And that's why I think that it was such a good idea that LSP came with this. But then LSP, they could have done it, I would say, without me, found out that another very important parameter was having an operational partner that had done it from an operational point of view, that has taken one company public in the US, that has managed a company both in our case, Europe and in the US, and that has done this transaction and this transformation of the company from one place to the other. And that's where they went and recruited someone like me to help them and ask me to become this operational partner in charge of the SPAC. So what I will tell them, like with anything, is that the team is the most important part. And I think that now that the market has become a little bit more choppy, investors are being more attentive, and they are distinguishing more who is behind that. And I think that unless you have a very good team, chances of raising the capital needed with the right investors are tough.
Right. So at the end of the day, it always comes down to who's running it, what's the team like. So you got to make sure that you have the best SPAC sponsors out there. And I think that's really one of the big reasons why we've been seeing so many SPACs going on, is the quality of these SPAC sponsors is going up considerably than where it has been in the past. In the European realm, we've got the likes of you with LSP. It's quite the unbeatable team there. So Eduardo, it's been a pleasure having you on the podcast today. Thank you for taking the time to give us your insights on the world of biotech companies and European biotech SPACs. And I wish you the best of luck with EBAC and LSP.
Yeah, thank you very much. And thank you for the invitation and for allowing me to explain all these things so painfully. And good luck as well to you with this series of podcasts.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the first episode of the Life Sciences Revolution podcast. Hope you enjoyed and hope to see you back for the next episode. And now, here's In Motion by Jank Setup to close us out.